afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live Monday through Friday for an hour each weekday, taking your phone calls. We have an open phone line right now. I think the lines are not open. I think they're full, but I'm going to give you a phone number, and if you have this phone number handy, you can call anytime during the hour, and if you find that the lines are busy, of course, you won't be able to get through, but you'd be surprised. If you find the lines busy and you call back in a few minutes, many times a line will open up. That's partly because the caller I'm speaking with will sometimes move along and then there a line open up. And sometimes people who are waiting just find they can't wait and so they hang up. So just because I say the lines are full doesn't mean they'll be full in a few minutes from now. So the number to call if you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith or if you have a different viewpoint from the host on anything and want to talk about it, the number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. And again, the lines are all busy right now, so I'm going to go quickly to the phone lines. I understand that depending on who your phone provider is, if you call and our lines are all full, you may either get a busy signal, which makes sense, or something that doesn't make as much sense. Some callers say that they get a message that the line is not in service, which is not true. So don't listen to those kinds of messages. Just realize that that's what your phone service gives you instead of a busy signal. Let's talk to some of these people so some of these lines will not be busy any longer. Let's talk to David from Auburn, Washington, first of all. David, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks, Steve, for taking my phone call. I appreciate that. I appreciate your services for the ministry. God bless you. And my question for you is on First Timothy chapter 1. If you can please give me some commentary on verse 19 and 20, and if this is talking about someone, what it means to shipwreck your faith, if that means that someone who was in the faith and then lost their faith, if my question makes sense, and if I could please take my answer offline.
Of course. All right, David. Thank you for your call. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know you wanted to say something else. I was just pushing the button to release your line. I didn't mean to hang up on you at the beginning of another sentence. In the passage you mentioned, Paul is warning Timothy about some false teachers in the church. And one of them, he says, is Hymenaeus, and the other is Alexander. And Paul says, whom I have delivered to Satan that they might learn not to blaspheme. Now, he said teachers like these have caused some people's faith to become shipwrecked. The way he puts it is, concerning the faith, they have suffered some having rejected. Well, I mean, the sentence begins a few verses earlier. That's how Paul is. I'll start in verse 18 and we'll get it all. This charge I commit to you, son Timothy, according to the prophecies previously made concerning you, that by them you may wage the good warfare, having faith and a good conscience, which some having rejected concerning the faith, have suffered shipwreck. And then he mentions these two teachers as being among the false teachers that caused this. So your question had to do with people having their faith shipwrecked. Well, there can't be any positive way to interpret this. Of course, there are people who would say you can't lose your salvation, but we are saved by faith. And if we lose our faith, well, then how can we be saved by faith? And there are people who've lost their faith. There are people who've had faith. In fact, Paul told Timothy in another place, many shall depart from the faith. In fact, in the same epistle, in 1 Timothy 4, verse 1, he says, now the Spirit expressly says that in the latter times some will depart from the faith. So there are people who have been in the faith, and that's the only way you could depart from it, is if you were once there, and have departed from the faith. And he says they listen to doctrines of demons. Obviously, in chapter 1 of the same book, he's got this in mind. There are people who have already departed from the faith. He uses the term shipwreck simply to, I think, be graphic and suggest that their faith has come to utter ruin. A shipwreck is, a ship that's no longer going to sail. It's wrecked. It's gone. And often it's in the bottom of the ocean now. So the idea that their faith has become shipwrecked just means that their faith has been destroyed. And it's just a graphic illustration. There may be some sense in which Paul wants to compare faith with a ship in other respects. I don't know of anything that comes to mind immediately that would suggest it, although we do know that in Hebrews chapter 2, the writer of Hebrews says, therefore, this is Hebrews 2:1, therefore we must give the more earnest heed to the things that we've heard, lest we drift away. Now, drifting away here is a term in the Greek that does refer to a ship which was anchored, but its anchor has come loose and it's drifted away from where it was anchored, and very possibly while the sailors slept or something. So they wake up the next morning, they're somewhere different than where they were the night before, and they didn't know that they were moving. And that's how it may be for some people, too. He says we need to be careful so we don't drift away. Again, it's a ship image. Some people, perhaps they don't lose their faith completely, but they drift from where they should be and need to, you know, recover their position. But if the ship is wrecked, then they're done. I mean, then I would suggest that Paul is describing people who no longer believe and therefore are not saved any longer. That's how I would understand it. I suppose that's what you're asking, because you didn't ask more specifically, but I think that was probably where your question lay. Todd from Utah, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You had a question about the races of people. Like, I was thinking a couple weeks ago about, like, the American Indians and, like, the Asian race and the black race. And, like, I've always been taught that, you know, I believe that we all came from Adam and Eve, you know, roughly 6,000 years ago. And I was taught that, you know, over the environment and weather, you know, people change color, skins and stuff. But the feature of these people, I just don't understand how they could change over a short period of time like that.
Well, it doesn't take all that long for a few generations of children not to look very much like their parents, especially if they marry, you know, into families that don't look very much like them. Now, not only did we all come from Adam and Eve, but much more recently, we all came from Noah's family. And that's significant because, of course, Noah's family is even less than 6,000 years ago. More like, I think, 4,500 years ago. And so coming out of the ark, there was only this one family. And all the, as we would say, races of people. I don't like the word races because there's only one human race. But all the different, shall we say, varieties of people. They all came from the three sons of Noah. Now, some people try to picture that Noah's three sons were three different colors. You know, one of them was Caucasian, one was black, and one looked like an Asian. There's no reason to think that. Certainly the Bible would not give us any reason to believe that. But we would have to believe that within Noah's family, there was a sufficiently rich gene pool that over the generations, as they, you know, reproduced and so forth, that they that quite a few different varieties of skin color and looks came out. And that's not too surprising. For example, it's not rare at all for a couple to have three children today, and they have three different eye colors. One might have blue eyes, one might have brown eyes, one might have hazel eyes, okay? Well, that's eye color is a variety. Skin color is a variety, too. So people have more than one child, and one is much more, you know, swarthy. One more brown colored than another. Not so much, you know, a black and a white child in the same family. Although that may be depending on, you know, the background of the parents. The thing is, I mean, if we look at creatures other than humans, horses, cats, dogs especially, probably dogs more than any other creatures, you can see how within one species, a huge number of varieties can arise. There's no reason to believe that the 200 breeds of dogs that we have now did not all arise from one kind of dog a long time ago, not very long ago, and new breeds of dogs have been produced in modern times. And you can see how different dogs are. They're not only different in color, but in their hair, length and thickness, their size, certainly, even the shape of their heads and bodies really differ from each other, and yet they're all one species. And that's because the original dog certainly had a rich gene pool, which through various breeders, ingenuity probably, and maybe a little bit of natural cross breeding in, within the family, certain traits became established in certain groups, but they're all from the same original. Now, the differences between varieties of dogs are much greater than the varieties within different varieties of people. People all look a lot more the same than dogs all look the same. In fact, you can always tell a human being at first sight. If we weren't familiar with some of these breeds of dogs, we might not know they were dogs. You know, if we were only familiar with one kind and we saw an entirely different kind, we might not know. So they can be very different from each other. And humans obviously have a rich gene pool. This is clear by the fact that an Asian can marry an African-American or African person, or, you know, a white person can marry, you know, a black person, and they can have children together. They're the same species. Obviously, all humans are the same race, the same species. But all the genes that code for all the different colors and all the different varieties of eye color and hair types and skin types and things like that, and body styles, all those genes were in the original family. It must have been in the original family that came off the ark. So my understanding would be that when they came off the ark and began to have children and grandchildren, that there were among their offspring people of, you know, expressing different colors and things like that of skin and hair and eyes and so forth. And what is commonly the case, certainly it's not universally the case, but very commonly the case, that people find attractive others who look a lot like them. We typically think of ourselves as the standard of what's normative. And then we kind of judge other people by how much they resemble us in important ways. And that being so in human nature, it's probable that people who had similar colors of skin and other aspects of their looks were attracted to others of the same sort and eventually married them, and those traits became established in groups. And so there's no reason to believe, for example, the idea that some people moved down to Africa and they got, you know, so much more sun that their skin got dark, because that would suggest that, you know, acquired traits like suntan could be passed down genetically. And that's not believed by modern science to be the case. Darwin believed it, but modern science certainly doesn't. But rather we could say this, that people with darker skin have more melanin in their skin, and that gives them a greater tolerance for harsh sunlight. Whereas people with less melanin and lighter skin have less tolerance for harsh sunlight. If you have no melanin at all, if you're an albino, you can't really be out in the sun much at all because you don't have tolerance to the sunlight. And so I would suggest that as people began to marry others who looked a lot like them and have children and grandchildren that tended to look a lot like them, that those, when they scattered out through the earth, those who had the darker skins found it easier to survive than the light-skinned people in the equatorial zones, in the hotter climates. And that's why you typically find the darker-skinned people there, not because the sun made them dark, but because their darker skin made it easier for them to survive and thrive despite the sun. Whereas the whiter people tended to, you know, gravitate to the less sunny areas in the far north. And so the more they became separated geographically, the more their particular traits would become established by intermarriage. And that's, I suppose, I mean, this is something that I would assume would happen even if I knew nothing of the data. If I didn't even know there were a lot of people in the equatorial zones who were darker than the people up in Scandinavia, I would assume that this would be the case. And that is the way it is. So I'm guessing that this theory has some merit. I don't know if this is exactly how it happened, because no one was around documenting it. But it's easy to see how it could happen. By the way, the human gene pool is rich enough that I've read that if two people who each have a black parent and a white parent, the people that we have called mulattoes historically, a man who has a black parent and a white parent, and a woman who has a black parent and a white parent, they get married and they have kids. If they have 9 children, it is possible for them to have white and black children and every hue in between, just from one couple. Now, I'm not saying Noah and his wife had children of different colors, but we can see that those genes are in the human race, are in the human family, and they can be in a single couple. They apparently were in Adam and Eve, because Adam and Eve gave rise to all the rest of us. So those are the thoughts I would have in trying to answer your dilemma.
Okay. I appreciate it, Steve, and thanks for your radio show. I appreciate your teaching and the wisdom you have.
Well, thanks for your call, Todd. Good to hear from you today. All right. I know you're calling from Utah. I don't think you were a Mormon. Probably you might have been, but I know the Mormons believe that the black skin and that the Native American dark skin came from a curse, as described in the Book of Mormon. And that's a common view, I'm sure, in Utah where you live. But I don't think, first of all, it's not, the Book of Mormon, I believe, is not true. And secondly, we don't need, you know, supernatural curses from God making people dark in order to account for the various skin colors that are out there. All right, let's talk to, let's see who's been here longest. It looks like David from Portland, Oregon. David,
hello.
Good to hear from you.
Hello.
Welcome.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
My question is, you know, there's so much imagery in the Book of Revelation, so then when we get to the battles, you know, like the Battle of Armageddon, the battle in Ezekiel, you know, we go back and we're saying, oh, well, you know, they're using spears and bows and arrows, so it can't be a future battle. But all this stuff is so figurative. Why can't we apply the same type of figurative interpretation to the battles?
Oh, we could. We could. In fact, we must. There's so much noise in the background, I'm going to put you on hold because I'd rather not hear all those people in the room talking at the same time I'm talking. But you're still on, so don't go away. I believe that when we look at Ezekiel's battle, and you're talking about Ezekiel 38 and 39, where it's the Gog and Magog battle, you're saying, well, there's references to them using spears and bows and arrows and wearing armor and riding horses and things like that. And why couldn't we simply understand that to be symbolic for modern war equipment and war weapons? Well, we could if we had reason to do so. But I would point out something else. That there's also in the battle references to fire and brimstone coming down from heaven and destroying 5/6 of the invading troops, so that it takes 7 months to bury the dead, there's so many, and 7 years to burn the weapons that were used. And these figures are often taken more literally than the spears and the bows and arrows by modern popular prophecy teachers. In other words, a dispensationalist, and I don't know if that's what you are, but that's the kind of, the question you're asking would be a kind that you, that they would like to ask. And they would say, well, the fire and brimstone, that's literal. That has never happened, so it's got to be a future battle. There's never been a battle where they had to burn the weapons for 7 years and take 7 months burying the dead, where 5/6 of the invading army were killed. So that must be a future battle. And therefore, even though the text refers to ancient warfare, we'll just assume that since it's a future battle, that the description of ancient warfare really is symbolic for modern warfare, because, after all, nobody fights with bows and arrows anymore in war. Now, that is one way to look at it. The other way to look at it would be, well, maybe it's the fire and the brimstone and the 7 years of burning and the 7 years of 7 months of burying. Maybe that's the symbolic part, and the bows and arrows and the spears are the literal part. You see, you've got two sets of features in this battle that influence us one way or the other. We have to say some of it's symbolic. If we're going to say, well, the fire and brimstone is literal, then we have to say, well, it's a future battle because that never happened, and therefore the ancient armaments that are mentioned must be symbolic of modern ones. But if we say, well, but the armaments are literal, then we'd say the fire and brimstone is not literal. It speaks of some other great judgment comparable to the destruction that God brought on Sodom and Gomorrah, though not necessarily implying it was by the same means. It's the imagery that comes from the story of Sodom and Gomorrah that has been used there. Now, we have choices. We have to say, okay, part of this has got to be taken literally, and part of it has to be taken symbolically. I suppose we could take all of it symbolically, but the point is we can't take none of it symbolically. We have to either be symbolic in terms of the ancient armaments and weapons if we're going to have a modern battle, or we have to take symbolically the outcome with the fire and brimstone and this 5/6 of the armies being killed and the 7 years burning the weapons. That's the symbolic part, in which case the battle might be literally have been fought with bows and arrows and spears. So You know, you got to go one way or the other, usually. And usually the dispensationalist who wants the battle to be future, they say, well, that's that fire and brimstone coming from down from heaven that tells us it's a future battle. But Ezekiel doesn't say it's a future battle. In fact, this battle is described immediately after chapter 37, where God talks about how he's going to bring the Israelites back from Babylon, back to their land. And then it says, and then Gog will come and try to invade their land. So, I mean, there could be thousands of years implied between chapter 37 and chapter 38. However, the two follow each other logically enough that we might look for a fulfillment of both around the same time. So Ezekiel 37 was fulfilled when God brought the Israelites back from Babylon, because that's, of course, what it says. 38 and 39 seemingly would describe some battle that happened after that, but maybe not thousands of years after that. You're back on now.
Oh, okay. Well, that kind of helps me with that question. So
all
that's
right.
Fine. Thank you.
Okay, David, thank you for your call. Good talking to you today. Okay, let's talk to Carol from Washington State or Washington, D.C., one or the other. Hi, Carol. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you, Steve, for taking my question.
Yes.
I was listening to your lecture on Exodus Part 2, and about three-fourths of the way through, you were saying that talking about the all-millennialism, that mm-hmm. say he drank, and halfway through, he drank and tasted the wine, and then that would be follow up on Matthew 26:29.
I'm sorry, who drank wine? I don't know who you were talking about here.
Jesus.
Oh, okay.
Jesus said, I will not drink henceforth of this fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom. And so you were making the point of all millennialism that his kingdom came in at that time because he drank of the wine on the cross. And so I went through the four Gospels, and Matthew 27:34 says he would not drink that it was gall, and he would mingle with gall, and he would not vinegar mixed with gall, and he would not drink it.
Okay.
Mark 15:23 said it was wine mingled with myrrh, and he received it not. Luke 23:36, the soldiers mocked him and offered him vinegar. Doesn't say what happened then.
Right,
and,
but in John's gospel, he does take it. So. You know, when we harmonize the
gospel, in John's gospel, in where I read it, said a vessel full of vinegar, they filled a sponge with vinegar and put it to his mouth. When Jesus had received the vinegar, he said it was finished. Is vinegar considered wine?
Well, I think it was the fruit of the vine, I believe. Yeah, I think it was bad wine. There's a fine thin line between vinegar and wine. And it comes from the same source. I mean, wine that is made poorly becomes like vinegar. So I believe that what they have was, he said, I will not drink of the fruit of the vine anymore until I drink it with you in the kingdom. By the way, the interpretation that you're saying I gave is not one that I have ever been dogmatic about. It's one that I've suggested as a possibility, since it's unclear what Jesus was talking about. When Jesus said, you know, I will not drink of the fruit of this vine until I drink it anew with you in the kingdom. I am aware of a number of possible interpretations of that, including the one you mentioned. And I usually mention more than one as a possibility, or at least I mention that the one I'm suggesting is only a possibility. But the point is that when you harmonize the four Gospels, John often tells us about events that are left out of the others. And apparently they offered Jesus this substance early in the day that he was crucified, and he rejected it. But then John tells us that he finally tasted it and said, it is finished, and ended it. So he did finally take of the fruit of the vine, assuming that, I mean, I don't know what else they'd make vinegar out of. They made wine out of grapes. We might make wine out of all kinds of fruit and things like that. But generally speaking, wine was considered to be made from grapes in the Middle East. So my guess is that the vinegar was made from grapes as well.
Okay, and I haven't heard your lesson on doesn't want to roll off my tongue.
Amillennialism. Yeah.
And but I noticed in Luke 9:27, but I tell you the truth, there will be some standing here which shall not taste of death till they see the kingdom of God.
Right.
Would that be a pro-amillennial statement? Verse?
Yes. Yes, it would be. The idea of amillennialism teaches that Jesus established his kingdom when he came the first time. But it's a kingdom that began like a mustard seed and has been growing for 2,000 years. Eventually, when Jesus returns, it'll be a universal phenomenon. But it started out very small. It's been growing throughout history. And eventually, it'll be universal, as Jesus will reign over every part of the world. Every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus is Lord. So that's the view of the kingdom that you'd normally find outside of premillennialism. And even premillennialists sometimes will hold it, but dispensationalists usually say the kingdom was postponed and won't be established until Jesus comes back. Yeah, I need to take a break, but I appreciate your call. You're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. We're going to take a break for 30 seconds and come back for another half hour, so don't go away. Please stay tuned.
Small is the gate and narrow is the path that leads to life. Welcome to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Steve has nothing to sell you today, but everything to give you. When the radio show is over, go to thenarrowpath.com where you can study, learn, and enjoy with free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all The Narrow Path radio shows. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. See you at thenarrowpath.com.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're continuing to take calls for the next half hour. Again, our lines are full, but the callers do move along and lines open up. If you want to give me a call at some point during this half hour, you want to have this number handy. The number is 844-484-5737. You give me a call and we'll talk about whatever is on your mind. We're going to talk next to our only caller that we ever get from Thailand, at least the only one we've gotten so far. And we hear from Andrew fairly often, but it's good to hear from you again, Andrew. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'll be quick today. Sure. The other day, I loved the question from our brother Don in Washington regarding amillennialism and what do we expect in the future. Do you have any, every once in a while in your lectures I come across a paper that's referenced. Is there a repository or archive that I can access to get all that paperwork and those resources?
Most of the lectures at our website were given in classroom when I ran a school in Oregon called the Great Commission School, and those lectures were the lectures from the classrooms. In those classrooms, we often had notes, handouts that we gave to the students. And most of those notes are still on my hard drive. We don't have them posted on the website. I think it'd be great to have them all there someday. And I think there's some discussion of it, but changes happen very slowly at our website, generally speaking. If you wanted to write to me, and this is true of anyone listening, anyone who wants to email me, steve@thenarrowpath.com, and ask for some specific notes on some specific lecture series, if I have them, I'll email them to you.
Yeah, it's amazing. Okay, so my question is regarding the little horn in Daniel 7. In your lecture, you mentioned some people think that that's the Antichrist, but I don't think you expounded on it. Would you mind expounding on it now?
Well, the Antichrist, conceived of as modern people conceive of the Antichrist, namely as some kind of a future world dictator who will oppose Christianity and oppose Judaism, some kind of a monster, sort of a Hitler on steroids. This idea of a future Antichrist is based on very, very little biblical data. Many people identify the beast of Revelation 13, the first beast, with the Antichrist, this one that we're talking about. Most often he's identified with the man of sin, the man of lawlessness in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Also the little horn in Daniel 7 is sometimes thought to be the Antichrist. And also the willful king at the end of Daniel 11 is sometimes thought to be the Antichrist. Those are the main passages which are used. And my position has been that none of those passages necessarily speak of an individual person who's going to arise at the end of the world. The word Antichrist itself is not found in the Bible except in the book of 1 John and the book of 2 John. And there, it's not found in Revelation or any eschatological passage. It's the word Antichrist is found as a generic. John says, whoever denies that Jesus is the Christ, the same is Antichrist. He said, you've heard that Antichrist is coming, and now many Antichrists have come. And so, the Bible nowhere speaks of one individual person who's the Antichrist, but the only use of the term Antichrist in Scripture is used generically for anybody who denies Jesus as the Christ, and that's been millions of people, of course, have lived and died denying that. So, now when it comes to the beast of Revelation 13, or the man of sin in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, there's really nothing about the description of them that would make us believe they're talking about the same individual or that they are even talking necessarily about an individual. The man of sin sounds much more like an individual than the beast does. The beast doesn't sound like an individual at all because it's got seven heads and 10 horns, which represent seven kings and 10 kings, respectively. So, I mean, we're talking about a lot of individuals here. It's a system. It's a system of governance, not a person. Just like Daniel's beast, in the same chapter you mentioned, in Daniel 7, there are four beasts that come out of the sea, and they're not individual men. They are empires that succeed each other. And Revelation takes those four beasts and merges them into one. Daniel sees a lion, a bear, a leopard, and a beast with 10 horns. The beast in Revelation has the mouth of a lion, a body like a leopard, feet like a bear, and it has 10 horns. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, obviously what Revelation is doing is taking the four beasts of Daniel and merging them into one image. But none of the beasts in Daniel or Revelation are represented as an individual person. Now the little horn, on the other hand, in Daniel 7 does grow out of the fourth beast. And very commonly, the little horn is identified by popular prophecy teachers as this idea of a future world dictator Antichrist. It's not, of course, impossible for that to be true, but it's very unlikely because he grows out of the fourth beast. The fourth beast is, by almost all evangelical estimates, a reference to the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire fell back in the 5th century, and therefore, if the little horn was to grow out of the Roman Empire, it would have to grow up prior to or just after, the fall of the Roman Empire, because that's what the fourth beast is, the Roman Empire. Mm. So, we're not talking about something, a man who's going to rise up in the end times. Now, we might be speaking of an individual. The little horn could be an individual, though many Protestants have felt and strongly taught from the Reformation on that this was a reference to the papacy, that this is the papal power personified as a horn with a mouth that blasphemes and so forth and persecutes the saints. And this would certainly correspond with the history, because when the Roman Empire fell, it was, in fact, the papacy that kind of picked up the mantle did persecute everyone who disagreed with it. The Waldenses and others who were true Christians were tortured and killed and so forth. So the little horn did waste away the saints and persecute them, did blaspheme. Certainly the popes have made amazing claims for themselves, claiming in some cases even to be God, if you read enough of their quotes from history. So in other words, the reformers all believed that the little horn in Daniel 7 was the papacy. And they felt the same way about the man of sin. They felt like the man of sin was the papacy also. Whether that's true or not, the passage is, I guess, sufficiently obscure to allow more than one possibility. But the idea that it's some future individual Antichrist is, it doesn't fit the time frame of the vision.
Okay. Wow. Okay. And it would be too much of a request to ask you if I emailed and asked for a zip file with the documents. I should wait and ask individually, right?
No. I mean, if you want, are you going through the eschatology series at our website? Is that what you're,
I'm going through everything. I'm going through Matthew with you. I'm going through Romans with you.
Okay.
I'm going through.
I should point this out to anybody before they start asking me for notes. I don't have notes on my verse-by-verse teachings. I teach those from the top of my head or from notes that are written in the margins of my Bible. I give those mostly extemporaneously. But I do have notes of the book introductions. So for every book of the Bible, I have extensive notes of my introductory lectures. But when I start going verse by verse, I don't have electronically produced notes on those. So I do that without notes.
Yeah,
but
whatever you've given me so far is pure gold. So if anything that I could get would be just so much appreciated.
Okay, well, maybe I could send you the notes on the eschatology series, because the topical lectures do have notes, and I can send those.
That would be so excellent. I'll send you an email just to remind you.
All right.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Okay, Andrew. Thanks for your call. God bless you over there.
All right, God bless.
Hope to see you sometime. Bye now. All right. Let's talk to Alan from Connecticut. Alan, thanks for waiting. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
It's fine, Steve. Good to talk to you today, sir. I've got three passages. I got one that's a basis and two cross-references.
Okay.
The basis is Matthew 5, verse 39, turn the other cheek.
Uh-huh.
Now we see in Acts 23, verse 3, Paul tells the overseeing priest a protest, and then he says, well, you're the high priest, and I'm going to mollify it. Now, the last one is John 18, verse 23, our Lord Jesus Christ, blessed be he, in his wisdom, says, if I spoke well, why did you smite me? It seems like people just don't take a smite without a protest. Can you tell me what turn the other cheek means? And this is of interest to me and perhaps other Christians. How do we apply this?
Yeah. Well, when Jesus was in the Sermon on the Mount saying, if a man strikes you or slaps you on one cheek, on the right cheek, turn to him the other also, he was definitely saying, instead of retaliating, you should absorb the insult. And he is talking about an insult. And so also Paul and Jesus, when they spoke up, the slap they received was an insult. It was not an attempt to break their jaw or knock them out or anything like that, like in a boxing match. It was a disciplinary for, in both cases, speaking what was thought to be, impolite to the high priest or whatever. Jesus and Paul both, when they were wrongly struck for saying something, they both issued a verbal protest. Now, what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount doesn't forbid that at all. You can turn the other cheek and offer your protest or your rebuke to the person. But the point is, the Sermon on the Mount is full of hyperboles. Whether people like to admit it or not, there's a lot of hyperbole. When he said, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. Or when he said, pluck out your eye if it's causing you sin. Or cut off your hand and throw it away. Or, when he said, when you pray, go into your closet and lock the door and don't let anyone see you do it. I mean, even Jesus prayed publicly, and so did the apostles. So these are hyperboles. Now, the purpose of a hyperbole is to emphatically make an important point, but not to be taken quite literally. Now, I have been struck one time, and I did literally turn the other cheek. I've been fortunate to have only been struck one time. And even having turned my other cheek, I didn't get struck again. The person didn't strike back again. But I don't mind taking it quite literally. I mean, I think it's quite a testimony if you literally turn the other cheek to somebody. But in the case of Paul and Jesus, and maybe in cases that we might face, there are times when protest is definitely appropriate. And the reason it would be in that case was because these were cases of injustice being done in Israel's Supreme Court. It was the Sanhedrin in both cases that ordered Paul to be struck and Jesus. And neither Paul nor Jesus had done anything to deserve it. So this was an injustice done by Israel's Supreme Court, and to protest injustice is very much in keeping with the Christian duty, I think. But of course, neither Paul nor Jesus struck back, and Jesus could have done serious damage to those people. I mean, he tells us himself he could have called 12 legions of angels and they would have taken care of those guys. But Jesus didn't. Jesus, in a sense, did turn the other cheek in that he did not retaliate, but he did speak out. Speaking out is not retaliation. Protest is speaking out the truth for the sake of the truth. And you know, many people who were martyrs, who were fed to the lions or burned at the stake, they preached and rebuked, you know, the pagans that were and the rulers that were doing that to them, and rightly so. Those people, you know, deserve rebuke. So to rebuke somebody who's doing an injustice, especially the legal institution that's supposed to be upholding justice, is not out of line. Now, Jesus, when he talks about if a man strikes you on one cheek, he's thinking particularly not so much that you're going to be in court and they'll strike you, but that some man's just, you know, someone doesn't like you and is slapping you to insult you or to get a rise out of you. And Jesus is basically saying, don't let him, you know, reduce you to their level. Just give the other cheek. And I actually think literally turning the other cheek is a great, great thing to do at times. But there would be times when it would make a lot more sense to run away if there's danger, or to rebuke or to do something else. When Jesus gives these instructions, Jesus is not trying to give a legalistic code. He's trying to teach us what it means to love your neighbor as you love yourself, and how to respond in the spirit of Christ. And so most people, if they get struck on the face, that it riles them up and they want to strike back. And Jesus is, of course, saying, don't do that. Resist that urge. Be gracious. You know, turn the other cheek. But turning the other cheek is not like the only response that would work. Jesus told his disciples in Matthew 10, when they persecute you in one city, flee to the next. So you don't have to just stand there and get pummeled if that's what's going to happen. You can leave. You can flee. So there's more than one response that the circumstances might call for. And when we read the Sermon on the Mount, and he says, give to everyone who asks you, well, if you take that legalistically, you better not listen to Christian radio for very long, because every program on the air asks you for money. You'll be out of money by the end of the first day you're listening. So, you know, you have to use some wisdom, but at the same time, he's teaching through hyperbole the need to do things that are radically contrary to what your first impression and your first impulse would be. I think that's what we find when we talk about turning the other cheek, or giving to everyone who asks, or going a second mile with somebody who makes you go one. Yeah, I mean, literally doing it may be a great thing to do, and it may be the right thing to do. But there's times when the principle could be observed without doing the literal act.
Thank you for your very diligent answer, Steve. Thank you very much.
Okay, Alan. God bless you. Thanks for your call. All right, our next caller is Gary from Pontiac, Michigan. Gary, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, Steve, I really appreciate your program. You're in California. Then there's a program I listened to in Detroit called End Time, and they're talking about the events that take place in the future. You were talking about Ezekiel. I have a question about that. But whatever is going to happen, the Word of God is written, and if those things are going to happen, then, well, we could be seeing them in the future, which I believe we will. But have you studied Europe, the Holy Roman Empire? Have you ever Googled that, the nations who were in it, Matt?
The Holy Roman Empire?
Yes.
You mean back in the days of Charlemagne?
Well, there were different dynasties. There's the Austria-Hungary, there was the Spanish Empire.
Okay.
There was all these empires who were in Europe.
Well, I've studied church history. I don't have expertise on every part of it. What are you bringing out about it?
Well, here's my point. You remember in Revelation, the fifth chapter, the rider on the white horse that goes to conquer nations and has a crown? Mm-hmm. Have you studied that?
I've studied Revelation fairly thoroughly, yes.
Yeah, I believe that's the Antichrist will come out of Europe, and I believe there will be a war in Europe. Have you heard that Spain and Austria have the title King of Jerusalem? You can Google that. Have you seen that?
I don't know that I've seen that, or I don't know if I would have remembered it. Why would that
be
important?
Yeah, I Googled it. I Googled the Holy Roman Emperor and the Habsburg Dynasty, which was Austria-Hungary that ended in 1918. There's a lot of history in Europe.
Okay, but I want to know, why is that going to be important to your question?
Well, because last year, Emmanuel Macron, he brought a 10-nation army together, and they're united. And Great Britain's in that, but they want to pull out of the European common market. So the thing's interesting in history.
Okay, Gary, do you have a question?
Pardon?
Do you have a question?
Oh, yeah, I wanted to find out. You were talking about what you believe about Ezekiel. I believe that's literal, and that's future.
Uh-huh.
And we
Which
will
part?
See it.
Which part is literal?
And then Then the other part was Revelation, the rider on the white horse. Do you believe that's the Antichrist?
No, I don't.
It goes to conquer nations.
No, the answer is no, I don't. But let me ask you, which part of Ezekiel 38 do you think is literal?
Okay. Well, I believe the whole thing, Ezekiel 38, 39, when it talks about the nation will come against Israel, there'll be a large shaking in the earth, and many people will die, and it'll affect the whole earth. And then for 7 months, they'll bury the weapons. All of Israel, it says, will bury the weapons.
Well,
so,
let me ask you, before you keep going, so you're saying you believe there's going to be a future battle fought with bows and arrows and spears?
The future battle of Ezekiel 38, 39, Magog, Russia, Turkey.
Right, and you believe they're going to fight with bows and arrows?
They'll have everything they have to fight.
Do they have bows and arrows in the military today?
See, well, they have archery groups and things like that. See, some of them will come out of lands.
Okay, you don't think they'll bring any artillery?
Oh yeah, they will. It'll be behind them. Christmas
okay, then Ezekiel doesn't mention that. It only mentions bows and arrows and spears and swords.
Well, what I'm saying, I know what you believe and what people believe, but if it happens,
no, I'm just talking about what it says. I'm just talking about what's actually in the passage. Okay, so
I believe
that's literal.
Be, yeah.
You believe
I
that's
believe
literal.
Everything
so
that's in there will happen literal.
Okay, why?
Because when they first come, they'll come to scare them.
No. Why do you think it's literal?
Because Ezekiel is prophecy for the future will affect the whole world.
Why do you think it's literal? Do you have an answer to my question? My question to you is, why do you think it's literal?
Because it's never happened.
How do you know?
Never. Because it said it'll affect the whole world.
But wait, Gary. That's not an answer. If I say, why do you think it's literal, I'm asking, how do you justify taking a passage that's written in symbolic, apocalyptic terms? How do you justify taking it literally? The answer is not because it hasn't happened. What?
We take the book of Daniel, and there's things that people misunderstood.
Okay.
And now they know there's it talks about the tribulation and the period of time that's given in Daniel. So
where's that? Where's that tribulation found in Daniel again?
What I'm saying, in the book of Daniel, it tells when the Lord Jesus would come to earth and give his life for the world.
Where in Daniel does it say that?
Now you're testing my brain. Okay.
I'm just testing your accuracy. Go ahead. Is there a passage in Daniel that mentions
the
Jesus?
To the coming of the Messiah was the number of days. And those days were in order, but then the part of the church was not, is the spot for the mystery that God didn't tell us about.
Okay. You know, what I'm hearing from you is not anything related to the exegesis of any passage of Scripture. I hear you just giving dispensationalist talking points. I myself was indoctrinated with dispensational talking points as a youth. And as a teacher, when I first began teaching, I would have said all pretty much the same things you're saying, because those are the talking points. When I got older, I decided I'd better read the Bible and let it speak to me, not let my teachers tell me what I'm supposed to think it means. And when I read the Bible, actually exegeted the passages, that's when my views began to change. Now, I'd love to talk to you more, but my lines are full, and honestly, sounds like we're all over the map on this call. But let me ask you, if you would listen to the lectures at my website called When Shall These Things Be? It's a series about end times. And it talks about these things that you're talking about. If you'd listen to that and then take notes of what you don't agree with, like what I say that you don't agree with, and call back and we can talk about maybe something specific that I've said that you don't agree with, and we can, you know, exegete passages together and see if there's any.
Thank you very much. I love your program.
All right, Gary.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you for calling. Good talking to you. All right, let's talk to Bruce from Beaverton, Oregon. Bruce, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Real quick, two focus questions.
Uh-huh.
Going to Daniel 9. First, starting verse 15, Daniel's really, imploring God, or maybe it's Daniel, but Gabriel, but he's basically talking about Jerusalem, God's city, and so on and so forth. What is, help me with the derivation of the word Jerusalem. Why is this so fraught with God's image and so forth?
Well, Jerusalem, the word Jerusalem means city of peace. Yerum Shalom. Shalom is the word for peace, and that's the root word of Jerusalem. But as far as why it's important, it's simply important because David made it important, and he moved the Ark of the Covenant there, and eventually Solomon built the temple there where the Ark of the Covenant was. And therefore, I mean, through by bringing the Ark there, David was making Jerusalem the central place where people would come and worship God. So God allowed that. God, I mean, if he had done the same thing to Nazareth or to Capernaum, I mean, then I believe that city would be the one that was so great. There's nothing about the city of Jerusalem, apart from Dave, what David made of it, that would be in itself sacred or special. It was a Canaanite city inhabited by pagan Jebusites until David's time. Even after Joshua conquered Canaan, he failed to conquer Jerusalem thoroughly, and it wasn't until David's time that the city actually became a Jewish city as opposed to a pagan city. But once it did become a Jewish city, David made it the center of his kingdom and of the worship of Yahweh. And so that's what gave it its significance. It was not anything inherent or, you know, mystical or anything about the city. It's just, you know, it just became sort of like Washington, D.C. is to the United States. It just became the capital city. All right. So let's talk to Dale from Sacramento. Dale, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Steve. I wanted to ask you a question that concerned Adam.
Okay.
If Adam was the first man, then who was Eve? I mean, I'm sorry, then who were the Neanderthals?
Oh, who were the Neanderthals? Well, the Neanderthals were also human, as almost, I think it's the universal belief of anthropologists say that Neanderthals were human. They were Homo sapiens. And so were the Cro-Magnon men. Now, when I was a kid, which is a long time ago because I'm 65 years old, but when I was a kid, the common view was that Neanderthals and Cro-Magnon were kind of intermediates between apes and humans. But that's not believed anymore. They are recognized as you know, varieties of humans. Just like, you know, we were talking earlier about, you know, the black and the Asian and the white and the Native American peoples. They have different characteristics. If you, you know, check, you know, with the Eskimo people or the Australian Aborigines and things like that, you'll find that they look somewhat different in some ways than groups from other places. The Neanderthals were apparently a group of people that lived in Germany. That's where Neanderthal is. And they may have lived in caves, but they did have human traits. When I say human traits, I mean human cultural traits, including artifacts that they, things they made. They even seem to have buried their dead and had some religious notions. So the Neanderthals, I believe, would simply be human beings. And they were people who, would, like all human beings, were descended from Adam and Eve. But among those who descended from Adam and Eve, some became very, you know, civilized and some did not. Some went off into jungles and became the tribal groups that are there now who don't have much civilization as we would recognize it. And there are some people who think that Neanderthals had some bone diseases like rickets or gout or something like that, which may have caused the first finding of their bones to have misled the paleontologists who found them. But it's fairly universally understood now that they were human beings and therefore descendants of Adam and Eve. I'm out of time. I wish I wasn't. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. We are listener supported. And if you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to the Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593, or go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. Have a good weekend, and let's talk again Monday.